Hello. So yes, this is the full version of the third part of the Soul Music episodes about Susan, the one that I put the preview out for a few weeks ago now. People who listen to that preview will know that I was hoping to put out the second part first. I have recorded the second part and begun editing it, and it's a bit of a rambly mess. I really wrote the outline for that episode with Eden in mind. I was hoping to get some of his insight and have more of an informed conversation about the music industry and things based around some of the things in soul music. So I don't really know if it works with just me rambling on. And I don't know whether I want to put it out or not. I haven't finished editing it, so perhaps I will keep chipping away at it and see how we go. But it might also end up becoming, I guess, the second long-lost Unseen Academicals episode, along with the third Carpe Juggalum episode, which I swear I am going to do one day when I have completed a chart of all vampire fiction ever, and I can tell you the things vampires do and what everyone knows about them. But as for the second soul music episode, yeah, I don't know. It hasn't turned out in a way I feel comfortable publishing at the moment, and I don't have time to redo it or really spend too much time trying to pull it all together. So yeah, if it does end up being rescued and released, perhaps that will happen down the line. But for now, here is the full version of the Susan episode, which has been available on since the preview went up. So yes, if you do want access in advance to these episodes as I finish them, you can sign up there. I believe Listener Liz has taken the final of the cheaper tier, but I think the regular one is still fairly affordable. No, it's not a regular thing at the moment, but doing the best I can. Anyway, enjoy the episode, and just a reminder that the next thing that will come out will be the three episodes on vegetarian vampires, including one all about Discworld, and then in December sometime, I'll be dropping the Hogfather episodes, which I have finished up the research for and begun working on the outline. I'm actually, as soon as I finish recording this, I'm going to send off an email to the guest I have lined up for that episode and try and lock in a schedule, so hopefully that will be along in a more timely manner, but who knows. Anyway, thanks for listening, and I'll be back with the next one whenever I can. Thanks.
It's Discworld! It's Discworld! Podcast! Analysis! Yeah! Woo!
Okay, so welcome back to the third episode I'm doing on 1994's Soul Music. This time looking at Susan's side of the story, how she interacts with heroic archetypes and that of the sensible Susan, popular in 19th century girls' literature and orphans, as well as ideas about education, literature, and romanticism. I'm sitting here with Milton the cat, who is curled up on my lap and clinging to me. So if you hear some purring, that is him. I think the others are out on the couch by the fire, and I only bring this up because I'm also wearing my brand new Discworld shirt I got from the Discworld Emporium website that has a picture of Death with four cats, and it says, "Cats are great, aren't they?" Which I think they are. So I'm very happy that just like Death, I've settled on four cats. Pratchett the cat doesn't think so. He thinks three cats, or just any number of cats that doesn't include Milton, might be a good number, but he's not in charge, although he likes to think he is. I've also, sitting underneath my brand spanking new print of Death sitting in his study that I got off the Emporium website as well, and I've stuck in a fancy frame that I got from IKEA for $15. So that is now hanging in my office above my desk. And I also have one of the Unseen University that I've put up in my kitchen, next to a big poster of the Discworld itself, just the big fold-out picture that comes with, I think it was the Discworld Atlas I got that with, which was a cool thing I found at one of the book sales they have. The publishers are getting rid of all their unsold books at the end of the year. Found that, along with the Ankh-Morpork Atlas as well. So that's been up in my kitchen, so I might be a little bit obsessed, which is compounded by dedicating every moment of my spare time to researching and producing these episodes, but I think it's for a good cause. And I bring it up to also say thank you to all my Patreons who help support this podcast. I don't have the list of your names in front of me now, but yes, you also help fund things like that, and also cover my own Patreon subscriptions to the podcast I subscribe to, which I actually think the amount I'm paying and the amount I'm bringing in on Patreon at the moment kind of balance each other out. So you are keeping me stocked with reviews of international drag race seasons. Thank you. Also not sure how this episode is going to sound because I've been home all week with a throat infection, which has really been messing me up, though it seems to be subsiding. But I've also, just for my warm-up, that thing which is available on the Patreon, I did 45 minutes on the Chronicles of Narnia series. So went a bit overboard there and may have put a bit more strain on my vulnerable throat than I intended. But I'll see how I go. But yes, having focused on Imp and the other musician side of soul music in the previous two episodes, now going to look at what is clearly the breakout character of the book in Susan. And I'm going to do that now. In our early episodes, I think Eden was rightly critical of for being fairly underdeveloped in soul music, especially compared to where she goes in Hogfather and Thief of Time. I mean, she's considered a protagonist, but she really is secondary to Imp. Like, Imp is the main protagonist of soul music. And even Death kind of plays a more active and instrumental role in the story. So Susan is almost playing third fiddle, to use a musical metaphor, in a book where she is ostensibly the main character, or at least the hero of the story, and yeah, serves as more of an observer role. Like, she's kind of the average everyman viewpoint character. Like, she's the reader insert, almost, to observe Imp and Death's more magical and metaphysical adventures. And because of this, a lot of reviewers have been fairly critical of Susan in soul music. In his 2-star review from the Pocket Guide that we talked about in the earlier episodes, Andrew Butler says, "Susan's humanity serves to demonstrate Death's coldness and lack of taste, and by now perhaps we've had all the teenagers coming of age that we can handle," claiming that Susan doesn't come across so much as Death in drag as a half-hearted goth, and that maybe we need to see more of the Valkyries. And as I discussed with Eden in the earlier parts, I think that assessment is a bit harsh, and he's being fairly flippant about Susan here. I mean, I sort of get where he's coming from in that, you know, this is another Bill Dunksterman, and I guess following on from Mort, but also Esk and McGrath and Brother in Small Gods and Tepic and Coin, and I'm looking through the books at the moment, arguably even Eric, I guess, and Carrot as well. That there is a formula that Pratchett has perhaps settled into at this point, that coming to soul music and reading it for the plot, it might seem a little bit thin and repetitive. Although as we get into, I do think there is more there with Susan, at least symbolically. I think she is representative of some deeper ideas in soul music, even if she's not actively engaging with them or really affecting the plot itself. Kiki Cannon concurs with Butler in her 2018 thesis on Pratchett, Gaiman, and the Personification of Death, writing that although soul music introduces Susan, she struggles to really claim the hero status she would later gain, spending much of the novel as little more than a confused teen learning the exact same lessons her father needed to be taught during his brief turn as Death. Although, as Cannon concedes, Mort's journey was about learning to make the hard choices, whereas Susan's story, and that of Death in soul music, is about learning which things can be changed and which things must sadly be accepted, and that in the end, soul music's story is that of a girl's first real experience with the meaning of mortality. Right? It's a bit more of a personal story for Susan than it is of Mort, which is more of an abstract exploration. You could sort of sub in anyone for Mort, and he's just meant to represent someone put in that situation, right? It's kind of a fish out of water story, which on the surface it is for Susan as well, except her story is also informed by her family history and the metaphysical implications of her inheritance as well, which we'll get into. So Susan's story is a bit more singular and a bit more, just personal for Susan than it was for Mort. Nevertheless, Tansy Rayner Roberts similarly writes in her unauthorized essays on female characters of the Discworld that she couldn't help noticing that considering what a popular and memorable character Susan is, it's interesting how small a space she takes up in each of her books. While Susan grows up and develops into an awesome adult from book to book, the books are never actually about her. She's not a protagonist, but fills the role of a mentor or helper, wandering in and out of the story, being cross at people, exchanging banter with the minor supporters supporting cast and not getting in the way of the plot before finally being unleashed as part of an epic showdown. So she's including Hogfather and Thief of Time here. I mean, we haven't got to those books yet, and I think she does play a similar sort of ancillary role in Thief of Time, but I remember her being a fairly major and active character in Hogfather, so we'll see next episode when we get there. But as Roberts observes of Soul Music, Susan stays mostly in the background of her debut novel, only occasionally crossing paths with the band who mistake her for a groupie until the final act. And Roberts says that revealing at the end of a book that someone is actually the protagonist is not quite as effective as letting her be the protagonist all the way through, which I think is a little more pointed and damning than Butler's review. To give it a bit of a positive spin, though, Raina also points out that Soul Music does actually pass the Bechdel test, which I think we've talked about before, but if you don't know, is a test of female representation about whether in a piece of media there is a scene with more than one woman and no men interacting together about something that isn't a man. And Raina points out that, yeah, Soul Music passes this test due to Susan's early conversations with her headmistress and school friends, as well as the Valkyrie, but does maintain that the majority of Susan's scenes involve her interacting with more important male characters, such as Albert, the Death of Rats, as well as Reekley and the other wizards, and even Death himself. I think saying Albert is a more important character than Susan is the odd one out there for me. He actually ends up being damseled at the end of the book, and I don't know if I would say, and even Reekley and the wizards, though they play a more major role in the rest of the series, I hear subjects to Soul Music's powers and outside observers that call on and defer to Susan's knowledge, and even Death. Like, she is going to rescue Death, although, yes, again, he does end up taking over at the end and actually resolving things. But yes, Susan's interactions with her female schoolmates at the start do show that Soul Music is not necessarily as male-dominated a novel as it might seem to be, nor as Pratchett's books have predominantly been outside of the Witch series this far. Another criticism that Roberts makes, though, that I do think is a bit more accurate, is about Susan and Imp's blink and you'll miss it romance, as she calls it, which she notes is a pattern repeated across the Susan stories, noting that when attracted to young men, Susan will typically show no outward sign of this attraction whatsoever, and so it tends not to go anywhere. And we'll get back to this in Thief of Time, but yeah, Susan's attraction to Buddy and the other men in her stories is something that we are sort of told rather than shown. Like, throughout Soul Music, we're told that there is this sort of siren-like draw to Buddy that Susan is taken by, but she never really seems to express any desire for him outside of her duties as the Angel of Death. And she seems more motivated to save him from the Soul Music than to pursue him personal interests. Like, yes, his allure seems to be more that of a handsome rock star than anything substantial, which suits the book's themes, but yes, does become a repeating pattern, as we will see in the later books. Yeah, but beyond expressing concerns that her story isn't perhaps handled as well as it could be in reviews and things, also, the scholarship that does exist on Soul Music is overwhelmingly focused on the musical side of things rather than Susan's story itself. One prolonged examination of her character comes from the 2015 Gender Forum special issue on Pratchett's work, wherein Imola Balgodzi presents an examination of what she calls the curious case of Susan Stohelet, which is written as a response to Gideon Harbacorn's 2008 article, Cultural Palimpsests: Terry Pratchett's New Fantasy Heroes, wherein she notes, no female hero seemed to have impressed Harbacorn enough to be discussed, despite Susan fitting the article's focus on Pratchett's complete and thorough reinventions of modern fantasy heroes. Now, Harbacorn does mention Susan in the article, listing her alongside Death and Granny Weatherwax as some of Pratchett's primary protagonists, but he then dismisses them in a footnote for being hardly part of the particular evolution he is examining in his article. And I have some sympathy for Harbacorn here. The publishing process is an absolute nightmare, and sometimes you have a thing that you just want to say about one part of a book, and then you submit it somewhere and the reviewer feedback is, why aren't you talking about this part of the book that I care about rather than the thing you've written thousands of words about? And this paragraph and footnote dismissal of these other characters struck me as something Harbacorn may have gotten from a reviewer report that said, hey, you know, what about Granny Weatherwax and Susan? You know, why haven't you talked more about them? To which, you know, the real response he wants to say is because my article is about these other characters and someone else can write an article about Susan if they want, but this is the one I've written. Yeah, I think he's focusing more on the warrior archetypes like Conan the Barbarian and things in the early fantasy parody novels. So to then bring Susan and Granny Weatherwax into that is looking at a separate tradition. So yes, this is the sort of thing you might say, you know, that Susan and Granny Weatherwax are certainly relevant, but they are outside the scope of this article. Anytime you see outside the scope, that means they got a reviewer thing asking them to write an entire different article, often while also asking you to cut down on the word count. So you just have to sort of acknowledge that there are other things that could be said, but then come back to, but this is the thing I'm saying. So I don't know if HarperCollins' dismissal of Susan is necessarily as nefarious as Borgodzi is casting it there. And he is right in saying that the complicated way that Susan and several others of Pratchett's female protagonists interact with the hero discourse, especially that of the fantasy hero, cannot be adequately worked out in a paragraph or a footnote. But as his article's title suggests, HarperCollins' analysis is based around the idea of a palimpsest, which is a page or other writing surface from which the original text has been effaced or partially erased and then written over by another. It's also used in geography to describe a structure characterized by superimposed features produced at two or more distinct periods. So this is replacing something by writing over the top of it, but parts of the original are still discernible, so it's not just like completely erased. There are bits of the original still present, still showing through that new idea that's been laid over the top. And I think perhaps this is a pertinent criticism of HarperCollins' article, is that he doesn't really define this idea of the palimpsest. I mean, just the definitions I've given there are sort of more than he gives in the article, which he just sort of throws out the name, goes and talks about the characters and gets to the end and goes, so therefore they're all palimpsests. I don't think he really develops this idea of rewriting, or at least doesn't make it explicit throughout the article. But the point he seems to be trying to make about Discworld and Pratchett's evolution as a writer is that at first, he says, Pratchett simply ridicules the heroic tradition, but then moves on to a complete and thorough reinvention of the characters. And this is sort of the shift we see between the first like 10 books and the middle 10, which we're about halfway through with Soul Music, that the stories stop being direct parodies of things that have come before and start taking on their own meaning and relating more to the rules of Discworld itself rather than the broader fantasy tradition. HarperCollins focuses primarily on sword and sorcery fantasy, with Cohen and the scantily clad warrior women of the light fantastic and sorcery, which we'll revisit when we get to them. So yeah, Susan isn't really part of this sword and sorcery tradition, at least in Soul Music anyway. You could make an argument in Hogfather maybe. And she is introduced after Pratchett's turn from parody into satire has really taken place. So she's not really fundamental to it either. Although I think HarperCollins' dismissal of the witches is perhaps less justified, given that the figure of the witch is more relevant to sword and sorcery fantasy. And they do seem to be a separate tract within those first 10 books that are sort of alternating between the witches and the wizards novels. And I think where the later series goes certainly has more in common or a stronger lineage towards the things he was doing at books like Equal Rights and Witches Abroad than the early wizards novels. But yes, we will come back to those in a year or two. And HarperCollins also presents a more engaged examination of Susan in his and Verena Reinhardt's 2011 article on magic, adolescence, and education in Discworld, wherein they note that Susan's education and her own teaching illustrate a view of schools as not necessarily the best place to get an education. That is a horribly constructed sentence. And while this article is not hero-focused, this article is only referenced once by Borgodzi, and then only in relation to Tiffany Aching. So there is perhaps an overlooking of a HarperCollins analysis here. But ultimately, however, Borgodzi argues for Susan's rightful place among Pratchett's new fantasy heroes, noting that her character fits HarperCollins' definition of Pratchett's palimpsests on several points, and that several heroic archetypal elements went into the construction of Susan's character. So I'll go through the characteristics of the hero that she lists, and then I'll go back in and sort of say and examine what I think of them in relation to Susan. So she says, or rather HarperCollins says, that first, the hero embodies part of the social unconscious to tell society what's on its mind. The hero establishes himself in the external world by taking place that is rightfully his. He steps into a rank he was meant for and was in fact born for. The hero is an individual who, faced with the situation, deals with it in a way that displays the kind of abilities a society prizes. And fourth, that the hero's adventure is one of healing, for he and his world are wounded and in pain. And Borgodzi says that if you replace the masculine pronouns in these statements with the feminine version, then these statements are all true of Susan Stohelet. So to go back through them again, the hero embodies part of the social unconscious to tell a society what's on its mind. Clearly, this is a link to the ideas of the Bill Dungsroman that we explored in relation to Mort. And I think of all the statements, this one does not really apply to Susan. I mean, part of the criticism about her is that she's just an observer. And yeah, as I've sort of pointed out, her story is more personal general, even if not just being relating to her, right? She's engaging with ideas of grief and inheritance and responsibility, which are all very individual experiences. I don't think she's necessarily embodying a social urge or unrest, which is more prominently embodied in the Soul Music by Imp. So I don't think I'd apply that one to Susan. Secondly, the hero establishes herself in the external world by taking a place that is rightfully theirs, stepping into a rank they were meant for and in fact born for. Clearly that relates to Susan. Third, the hero is an individual who, faced with a situation, deals with it in a way that displays abilities a society prizes. This one, I'm not sure about. Does Susan really deal with the situation she's faced with? She does them in a sort of no-nonsense practical manner, but at the end she's not really capable of dealing with Imp, and it's Death who resolves that issue. So yeah, I'm not really sure about that one. Moira is Bugosdi notes, besides their healthy disrespect for authority, analytical abilities, and the nose of a detective, both Susan and Vimes have another far more momentous thing in common. They both know that finding a solution does not necessarily mean playing by the rules. Susan becomes a hero through rebellion, arguing that Pratchett has created a female character whose traits and story challenge gender-related stereotypes. And I'm not sure about that reading either, because again, as with Mort and some of the labor analysis that I did with Reaper Man, Susan becomes a hero by inheriting authority, right? She's not countercultural. Death is, he's not part of the bureaucracy or representative of the bureaucracy in the same way that the Musicians Guild or Vedinari is, but he is like the ultimate authority. Death and taxes, right? Which I'm sure is something that Pratchett was playing off in putting these two themes side by side in Soul Music. And I think Susan's arc is less about rebelling and learning to accept who you are and embrace your heritage and things like that as part of your identity, and to stop running from yourself. She is constantly opposed to the rebellious Soul Music. She's trying to, yeah, again, like more restore order rather than deviate from it. So, and we'll get into Vimes and the whole disregard for authority while also being a policeman thing that Pratchett's clearly engaging with in the Watch series when I get to that in 4 years. But the description of Susan as a rebellious character doesn't really ring true to me. And yeah, she, like Vimes, she also becomes this figure of authority, which even if she is doing things her own way, I think she represents institutionalized change rather than radical rebellion. And finally, the hero's adventure is one of mending the self and the world. Now, clearly, Susan is wounded and in pain, and that her adventure is one of healing. But again, like this first category, I don't know if that represents a broader healing for society. I mean, you could say that they ultimately have to heal Ankh Morpork from its exposure to music and Roxanne, but I don't think that analogy really lines up with Susan's story. And the sort of social criticisms and explorations that are going on in the novel, they're not really healing from anything. They're revolting against something, right? So, I mean, you could look at that as a healing, but I don't think that really lines up. So out of these four categories, I think it's only really the second about taking a place that is rightfully theirs and stepping into a rank that she's born for really applies to Susan out of those heroic definitions. So again, maybe Harpercorn was right to not include Susan in his analysis because she is doing something different than the earlier heroes of Pratchett's that he is examining. Another reason why Susan might not fit neatly into heroic archetypes and something that both Bugosdi and Harpercorn gesture towards is that Susan is a subversion of these heroic archetypes, as was Cohen and Mort as well. I think with them, it was a direct flip, right? Cohen, who we haven't really talked about on the podcast at all, but he is, what if the barbarian was old and implicitly frail, right? I mean, Cohen's still very capable, but yes, it's brushing up against this idea of the hero as young and virile, right? And then Mort is subverting the grandiosity and the metaphysical implications of being the angel of death with mundane labor and also his common unremarkable origins. They're just sort of a direct inversion, a complete flip. Whereas Susan, I think, is more complex and more subtle in her inversions, and also is perhaps a subversion of Pratchett's own subversions, might be my theory around this. Because we talked about how Mort was sort of playing with the idea of the hero's journey. And that final category of the hero, the one about the hero's journey being one of mending a world which is in pain, that's Harpercorn there explicitly appealing to Campbell's hero's journey and saying that heroism is not about rising to the top, fighting for one's rightful place in society, but rather about making one's society and oneself whole. So we're sort of getting a collapsing of the idea of the hero's journey and the Bildungsroman, which we treated as sort of separate ideas in relation to Mort. So to quickly step through the hero's journey, like we did with more, though perhaps in less detail. So first we have the call to adventure, which is represented by Binky and the Death of Rats, which yes, brings Susan out of the ordinary world and into Death's domain, and crucially, fantasy time, which is why Buckton would say it can't be a Bill Dungsroman. But yeah, Susan's whole story takes place out of temporal sequence so that she's returned more or less to the point in space and time where she started at the end of the book. So it's playing into that fairy tale ideal there and the hero's journey as well. We then have the refusal of the call, which I guess is represented by Susan's general initial resistance to Albert, but at the same time, that is like pretty quickly overcome. Like she isn't in denial for long because she remembers that this is where she actually belongs. And I think she takes on the responsibility fairly easily. So there's a bit of a gesture towards that, but we're already starting to see a bit of a subversion in that the thing that seems unreal and not normal to her is in fact the place where she belongs and comes from. We also have the supernatural aid, where we get the gifting of the trinkets and the training by the mentor, which Albert sort of stands in for, right? He gives her the scythe and the timers and things. But we do have somewhat of a subversion of the idea of the mentor here in that the whole point is that Death is missing. She doesn't get the Mr. Miyagi style training from him. It is in fact her job to go and find him without training. So yes, I think we're already seeing a bit of a subversion rather than an inversion of the hero's journey here. We next have the crossing of the first threshold. This is the first step on the quest and into the world of the unknown. But again, I think there's a subversion here in that her journey begins by returning to the urban city. And you could say the same for Mort, although yes, otherness for Mort was represented by Death's Domain, whereas for Susan, Death's Domain represents familiarity, and it's sort of the urban environment of Ankh-Morpork that represents the strange world that she then moves into from Death's realm. There's the Belly of the Whale, which is the acceptance stage of the journey. We already sort of talked about that with how quickly she succumbs to it, and there's the scene with the costume that I'll talk about later. As far as her trials go, I mean, Mort had the three engagements with the witch and the abbot and things, and then Kali was his third trial that he failed. And Susan, again, by somewhat of a subversion, is not allowed to fail her third trial. Like, she's trying to fail the third trial and save Buddy, or thinks he should be saved, but then decides not to save him, but then the music does it for her anyway. So there's something going on there. I mean, this is kind of a Binding of Isaac thing, where the test wasn't really a test. I'm not really sure about the trials, but like, clearly magical music saving someone from the Angel of Death, it's not really her doing, and this might have something to do with the perception of Susan as a character that things happen to rather than that things happen because of. But I think some of this powerlessness on her part is again a subversion of the traditional hero's ability to shape and change society. We then have the meeting with the goddess, or the woman as the temptress, which of course is an allusion to sirens and that musical temptation. And Campbell allows for a female hero in this stage, writing that when the adventurer in this context is not a youth but a maid, she is the one who by her qualities, her beauty, or her yearning is fit to become the consort of an immortal. Then the heavenly husband descends to her and conducts her to his bed, whether she will or not. And if she has shunned him, the scales fall from her eyes. So we've got some kind of invocation of this in that Susan is being tempted by Buddy, who is empowered by the immortal music, and we get the conversation with her later about how he thinks she's a groupie and things. Yeah, we have a bit of an inversion here where the seduction or the sexual implications are mostly on his part. Like, he is wooing her, but he also isn't really that interested in her or in the idea of groupies. And she's also saying to him, like, hey, I'm not a groupie. I'm trying to save you. So I think, yeah, we have a refutation of this temptation idea that implies some kind of sexual romantic attraction, but is sort of resisting it from both ends. We then have the atonement with the father, who has life and death power, which literally happens. I mean, this is the atonement with the grandfather, who has life and death power. But we then have apotheosis, which is the stage in the hero's journey where the hero is ready to face what is to come. Whereas soul music's whole point is the acceptance of grief, right? Is being ready to face what has already happened, facing the past and realizing that you can't heroically engage with it. You have to accept that it's happened and that you are powerless. So I think there's a fairly strong inversion there, given that that is sort of the ultimate test of the hero, and what makes them so heroic is their ability to change and influence history. Whereas yes, soul music is all about accepting that you can't do that. And Susan's ultimate breakthrough is when she does accept her powerlessness and her inability. So I think a fairly substantial subversion there. We then have the ultimate boon, which is the reward, which Campbell says can be the retrieving of a lover from death. Though of course, in soul music, we have a reverse Orpheus rather than venturing in the underworld to retrieve someone from death. Susan's whole quest is to retrieve Death and bring him back to the underworld, or at least his domain. So this is where we get more of the parodical inversion rather than the satirical subversion, but it's there. We then have the return stage of the hero's journey, the first part of which is the refusal of the return. Susan returns to the real world, but also asks if she can come back to visit Death's domain. So I don't know, depending on what way you look at this, this could embody the refusal to return in that she's still got one foot in Death's domain, but I think Susan is very happy to return both Death to his place and to return to visit Death. She's fairly acquiescent with returns, to me, it seems. The other part of the return, which this is the part of the hero's journey that I don't think the structure really makes sense, but we have the magic flight. Yeah, this is normally the escape of the hero, but in Soul Music, Susan and Death are the ones doing the chasing, right? They are pursuing Imp and the music. So again, there's a little bit of muddying of how the hero is cast, even if it is filling this narrative stage of there being a chase at the end. We then have the rescue from without, which definitely occurs with Susan, and also it's revealed Imp. And then we have the crossing of the return threshold, where Susan is returned to her world. As I said earlier, she's returned to when she was, so we do have this fairy tale time thing, which does stop it, I think, from being a Bill Dongthrumman in the societal way that Buckton and, it seems, Campbell are also saying, in that if no time has passed, society cannot have changed to represent Susan, right? Because nothing's happened. She has changed, but the rest of the world remains ostensibly the same, which is why we can have Buddy working at the chip shop in Ankh-Morpork, because it's not that all of this happened and then he didn't die and went and got a job at the fish shop. It's that none of it happened. He didn't move to Ankh-Morpork and become a musician. He moved to Ankh-Morpork and got a job working down the street, which again kind of ties into these economic ideas of music as an unsustainable, aggrandized career rather than a mundane but sustainable job of working in a chip shop. I'm not really sure how the timeline works, whether there is then two buddies or if this chip shop buddy replaces the Soul Music buddy, because we do have the reference, as I pointed out in the last episode, in The Truth with Otto yelling "Music with Roxanne." So we know Music with Roxanne happened, whether it happened in the way it's depicted in Soul Music, I'm not really sure. And this might speak in some way to Eden's criticism that the book doesn't really affect the continuity of Discworld. I mean, that could be attributed to the fact that these events are literally pulled out of the history of Discworld itself. Not quite sure how that works. So the last two steps of the hero's journey, we then have the hero being made the master of two worlds, which Susan is literally. She has become the master of herself in her regular Discworld life, and then is also a master of Death's domain. And then finally, we have the freedom to live, which represents the hero's freedom from the fear of death, which is in turn the freedom to live. And this certainly applies to Susan, but again, there's a bit of a twist, because Susan is not freed from the fear of her death. Susan is freed from the fear of other people's deaths. Yes, she is freed from grief for others rather than her own fears. So again, I'm not sure how many of these observations I'm making actually play into the hero's journey and how much of them subvert it. And, you know, I could spend a whole episode of months going into this and pulling it apart, but just to run through them all and sort of suggest what might be happening here, I do think there is some kind of subtle twist or subversion that Pratchett is making to this formula that also stands in as somewhat of a subversion of Mort's own hero's journey, in that that was about Mort resisting, I guess, the authority and the natural order of death and the duty, whereas Susan is, because of her no-nonsense nature, is sort of all too happy to play the role of the almost authoritarian, pragmatic Reaper, as opposed to Mort's more emotional and rebellious one. I mean, yeah, it's death and taxes. She is the ultimate tax collector, which I do not think is incidentally contrasted with the Musicians Guild and their membership collections.
If you knew Peggy Sue, then you know why I feel blue without Peggy. My Peggy Sue. Oh, well, I love you, girl.
Okay, so having looked at how Susan interacts with plot tropes and archetypes, I now want to look at Susan's character itself, which is actually suggested by her name, which is the character archetype of the sensible Susan, which I don't know if it's so much a thing these days, but has a rather prominent or at least significant literary history in the 19th and early 20th centuries. So in her 2018 article, The Susan, The Story of an Archetype and Why We Need Her, Alice Nuttall, who is not a witch with nice and accurate prophecies, as far as I know, she says, if you're reading children's literature from a certain era, a Susan is bound to pop up sooner or later. She will be the second child and the oldest girl. She will always be the group mum, keeping her siblings in line and standing in for their actual mum, who is always absent and sometimes dead. She will make sure that her brothers and sisters are fed, clothed, and have somewhere warm to sleep, and that they will not appreciate her for doing so. So this should be a fairly familiar character type for readers of English children's and fantasy literature from the periods mentioned. The earliest reference to Sensible Susan that I can find, and this was pointed out to me by listener Liz, who inspired the previous episode on Reaper Man, has also become quite a busy Pratchett researcher, it seems. As the oldest reference to Sensible Susan that she and I have found comes in a Georgian weekly from 1872 called The Plantation, which is some very suggestive name in there. But there's a piece in here which seems to be some kind of anti-women's suffrage propagandist kind of slice of life story called Uncle Sam's Daughters, which seems to just describe conservative American archetypes, cultural types rather than literary types. But anyway, in this piece, describes Sensible Susan, who with her clear-cut face, watchful moderate eye, and well-chosen dress, fills up the corners at Hopple Hall, where conversation does most prevail. Susan is too sound and practical not to know that marriage is her just and fitting career, and to know, too, within a fraction, how much love and income will be requisite to make the aforesaid marriage move upon well-oiled wheels. She proceeds to the business of her life, rationally, yet with feeling. Which sounds both like and unlike Pratchett. Susan, I think, and there's a few other pre-1900 examples, although this appears to be an earlier reference from 1796 in a collection of stories by 19th century Irish children's author Maria Edgeworth, which contains a story called Simple Susan rather than Sensible Susan, which is about a girl named Susan Price, who is a sweet-tempered, modest, sprightly, industrious lass who was the pride and delight of her village, and whom the upper-class attorney Mr. Case sees as an embarrassment to his own boisterous children, to whose education he had no time to attend. Now, it seems unlikely that Pratchett would have read or have been familiar with these stories. I mean, he might have been familiar with the children's collection, given that it came out in 1904, but why this reference is significant is that the particular illustration that accompanies the Simple Susan story in the 1903 collection is referenced in E. Nesbitt's 1904 children's novel The New Seekers, which describes this illustration in reference to a sensible rather than simple Susan. So the archetypes are getting crossed over there. Other notable early 20th century examples include Susan Sowerby from Frances Hodgson Burnett's Secret Garden, and also Susan Walker from Arthur Ransom's Swallows and Amazons from 1930, who make sure the washing up is done while she and her siblings are camping on their Lake District Island. And here we have an actual connection to Pratchett, because in a 1999 interview that I found published in The Guardian, there seems to be credited to The Observer, I'm not really sure where this was originally published, but in this interview, Pratchett responds to a question about whether he has any favourite fictional characters by saying that Swallows and Amazons always induced in him a terrible desire to be a pirate. I mean, that suggests some influence and at least confirms Pratchett's awareness of Swallows and Amazons and their Susan character within it. Though I think more significantly and more influentially on Pratchett and fantasy stories in general is, of course, Susan Pevensey, who wraps her brothers and sisters in warm clothes before they venture into the frozen wastes of C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia, which were published from 1950 to 1956, and is, of course, told to stay out of battles by Father Christmas since they become ugly when girls are involved. Patrons will be aware that I have recently read through the entire Chronicles of Narnia series in preparation for this podcast and the Hogfather one. And yes, I can confirm that Lewis's treatment of women and Susan in particular is not great. Also, if I didn't already point it out in the second episode, then I was very pleased, but also a little bit annoyed to discover that one of the books in the series, The Silver Chair, is also another example of an Orpheus fantasy, in addition to all the magical music and stuff I discussed in the first Soul Music episode. So, nice bit of coincidence there. But this sort of suggests that, along with just being a a general subversion of the Sensible Susan archetype. Perhaps Pratchett Susan is responding directly to Lewis's Susan, which is possibly suggested in the text when Susan is first confronted by the death of rats and asked to go looking for death. It says, "As Susan saw it, the world offered two choices. She could go back to bed or she could follow the rat, which would be a stupid thing to do. Soppy people in books did that sort of thing. They ended up in some idiot world with goblins and talking animals, and they were such sad, wet girls. They always let things happen to them without making any effort. They just went around saying things like, 'My goodness me,' when it was obvious that any sensible human being could soon get the place properly organized. Actually, when you thought of it like that, it was tempting. The world had too much fluffy thinking, and she always told herself that it was the job of people like Susan, if they were any more like her, to sort it out." So the reference to goblins and talking animals, as well as just being a reference to fantasy and fairy tale stories in general, is possibly suggestive, more specifically, of Tolkien and Lewis, being that goblins are from The Hobbit and talking animals are from Narnia. Although in Narnia, the talking animals is capitalized because there's a distinction between the talking animals, who you're not allowed to eat, by the way, and just, I guess, regular, mundane, non-talking animals who aren't capitalized, who you are allowed to eat, whereas Pratchett's version isn't capitalized, so it's not a direct reference there. And I would say that this is just sort of a general gesturing towards fantasy, maybe by way of Tolkien and Lewis, but not specifically aimed. If there wasn't then the direct reference to Narnia and the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe in Hogfather, where the Tooth Fairy Violet says that there are magic wardrobes, that if you go into them, you come out in a magical land. There's also a reference to a wardrobe, which is quite possibly a secret doorway to fabulous worlds. Earlier in Sorcery, there are the connection to Hogfather, which, as we'll get to, Pratchett clearly had in his mind while he was writing Soul Music, where there are lots of references to the Hogfather and Tooth Fairies littered throughout, I think suggests that he had Narnia on the mind. And having begun putting together a bit of the research for the Hogfather episodes, I think one of the angles I'm looking at it is as a direct response to or engagement with Lewis's Narnia series. So more about that in the Hogfather episodes. But I think if Pratchett's Susan isn't a direct reference to Lewis's Susan, then she's certainly part of the mix and a more prominent part, I would suggest, than any other Susans or fantasy characters that are influencing Pratchett's portrayal of his Susan in Soul Music. It is interesting, just going back to that passage from Soul Music there, that she's sort of both rejecting and embracing the sensible Susan and Narnian Susan's characters, or more specifically, she's embracing the sensible Susan's characteristics and rejecting the fantasy Susan's characteristics, right? She's saying, I don't want to go into a fantasy world like soppy girls like Susan in Narnia. But if I did go into fantasy worlds like Susan in Narnia, which Susan in Narnia does go into Narnia, I'd sort it out. Whereas Susan Pevensey, like, she does go into Narnia, but she doesn't really do anything or sort anything out. And a lot of the criticism of Lewis's portrayal of women and women's roles in Narnia does center around this character of Susan. There's an annotation on the L-Space Discworld wiki that says, contemporary fantasy writers, including Pratchett's friend and collaborator Neil Gaiman, frequently claim that the main or only poor point of the Chronicles of Narnia is the negative light in which Susan is portrayed in The Last Battle, that's the last book in the Narnia series, in which she rejects the world of Narnia by laughing at her siblings' continuing belief in Narnia as a childhood fantasy, and is then in turn rejected by it, by not being in the train crash, which kills the rest of her family and thereby sends them to Narnia and onto the heaven-like realm that's brought in by the final battle at the end of the series, because the L-Space annotator says of what is essentially the assertion of her independent femininity. Yeah, so for people who haven't read or are familiar with the Narnia series, at the end of the book, The Last Battle, there is a last battle. By that point, though, the series has sort of moved on from the Pevensey children, of which Susan is a part and who are the protagonists in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, the first book. They've grown up. They're told in one of the earlier books by Aslan, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, I think it is, that, like, essentially they're aging out of Narnia. They won't be able to return to it, and then we move on to a new set of children as protagonists for most of the later books. But yeah, in the final battle, Father Time, right, Death, awakens and ushers in the ashes in the end of time, which is the end of both our world and Narnia itself. And then this is one of the reasons why I really don't like Narnia, is that, yeah, at the end of the series, Narnia and I guess, our world, Earth, are wiped out because it's the end of time. But that doesn't mean it's the end of everything, because we get a new beginning in a new world where everyone who died in the last battle and everything is brought into this new Narnian realm of, like, it's heaven, right? The idea being that this world and Narnia, which is a parallel version of, I guess, the real world, but is still part of this time continuum, I guess, that all of that is just preparation to heaven, right? This is the Christian allegory that runs through it. And yeah, as a non-Christian, that really doesn't sit well with me. I mean, I don't really have a problem with the Christian symbolism and stuff in Narnia other than just how blatant and surface level it is. The ideas themselves aren't really that bad, except for this one I find quite troubling, abhorrent even. You know, I get that that might be personally comforting, but if I have a problem with Pratchett's portrayal of death not really being comforting because it's not real, then given that I don't think Christianity and heaven are real, I have a problem with that. That doesn't sit well with me. And for the thrust of Lewis's version of Christianity, or at least the version he portrays in Narnia, for the ultimate result of that to be, you know, deaths in this world are meaningless, lives in this world aren't valued because there's another life, which is also in the context of this book, The Last Battle, alludes to, you know, sending soldiers to war, and isn't it good that they can die for us? Yeah, as someone who doesn't believe in heaven, I think that rather cheapens life. And yes, Susan is precluded from that in The Last Battle because she has rejected the childish fantasy of Narnia, of heaven, of Christianity. And it says, you know, oh, she's obsessed with boys and makeup and things like that, right? This is the idea of the major female character in the early Narnian books coming of age, becoming a stereotypical girl, being treated not only as, like, superficial and insubstantial and unworthy of the other characters, but unworthy of going to heaven, right? So we're not only saying if you die, it doesn't matter because you'll go to heaven. We're now saying it doesn't matter if you die because you'll go to heaven, but also you won't go to heaven if you act like a teenage girl. It's troubling, to say the least. But I do think it's interesting there that we have a character named Susan, who was an adolescent girl, rejects the childish fantasies of those around her, being left as the lone survivor of a train crash, with the rest of her family is killed. There's some obvious parallels to some obvious in retrospect, but perhaps not obvious on first read, but I think rather subtle on reading, or at least first reading, references to Susan that Pratchett is perhaps setting up in Soul Music. This may have been coincidental, but that seems particularly pointed to me. Yes, and then the reference by the L-Space annotator to Neil Gaiman holding this criticism of Narnia led me to his 2004 story, The Problem of Susan, which the Wikipedia plot summary, which is on the Susan Pevensey, the Susan from Narnia Wikipedia page, the plot summary of this, of Gaiman's story here, says that we have a character, Professor Hastings, who strongly resembles an adult version of Susan, dealing with the grief and trauma of her entire family's death in a train crash. Does it sound familiar? Does it sound like anyone we know? Yes, I think with these death books, I've been conceding that some of the stuff with death and dreams and fantasy and things that Gaiman was actually doing prior to Pratchett in The Sandman, but here we have Gaiman reproducing a criticism of Narnia that I think is implied in Soul Music some 10 years after Pratchett did it already in Soul Music. And having read this story, I have to say, I think Pratchett did it a lot better, a lot more subtly. Not that subtlety is, you know, makes one thing better than the other, but this Gaiman story is pretty surface level. I mean, that Wikipedia summary, that's kind of all there is to it. There is a character who is implied is Susan from Narnia, who's interviewed by a journalist, and they have a debate about the ethics of Susan in Narnia. Like, there's no real reason for this to be a short story rather than just an essay by Gaiman. Other than that, I guess Gaiman feels like he is a short storyteller rather than a writer of literary criticism, I guess. But yeah, this is just like, these characters are mouthpieces for Gaiman's opinion, to the extent that, like, the entire story is just dialogue between them. So yeah, I don't think this short story is particularly profound or worth reading, even, especially when, if you avoid reading it, then you don't have to read through Susan's dreams of Aslan and the White Witch having sex, which make up the back half of it, which I thought were rather unnecessary. I did find it interesting, though, on retrospect, looking at my notes here, that the characters in Gaiman's story point out that what Susan is essentially punished for, as along with the original sin of Eve and the sexism of her femininity, is she is punished for not believing, which is maybe something we want to keep in mind going into Hogfather. So yes, I think here, at least, we're beginning to see the inklings of Susan and the later half of the Death series being a response to, or at least in conversation with, Lewis's Narnia. But yeah, so we'll come back to more of the Narnia stuff in Hogfather. Some other sources of inspiration for Susan's character by the L-Space and Annotated Pratchett file commenters include the goth icon Susie Sue from the new wave post-punk band Susie and the Banshees, who has the black hair with white streaks in it, so opposite of Susan's there, spelled S-I-O-U-X-S-I-E for those unfamiliar. And also Susan Foreman, the granddaughter and original companion of the First Doctor in the first Doctor Who series, so this is the original Doctor Who companion, which is an interesting coincidence given that Death's house is also said to be bigger on the inside than the outside, right? Some TARDIS vibes going on there. Responding to questions about the origins of Susan's name and character, however, I think we've read this quote out before, but Pratchett says that he had only noticed on signing tours that somewhere between the age of 10 and 18, girls with names like Susan or Nicola metamorphose into girls with names like Susan, Nicola metamorphosize into girls with names like Susie, 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 and Nikki, 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 and Nikki, right? This is all weird different spellings. I remember not being able to read this the first time, and the Susie and the Banshee spelling is one of those Susies there. What's interesting about this in reference to soul music as well as just as in discussion of Susan's character is Pratchett also adds that this is about the same time period that boys with names like Adrian and Robert become boys with names like Crash and Frab. Crash, of course, being the name of one of the characters in soul music who was in the and supporting acts band, and how they changed their names to sound cool there. But Pratchett says Susan got her name because it was the one of these who's got the most variation. Right, this is adding to that idea of the sensible Susan, that Susan's name is a subversion, or at least an acknowledgement of people in real life who are named Susan rebelling against this. So it seems appropriate for a character who is rebelling against her normalcy, or the other way around, as it turns out, are to be named Susan. And Pratchett says, yes, rather than Susie and the Banshees, sort of post-punk imagery, that Susan got her iconic black and white hairstyle because it's been a nice weird hairstyle ever since the Bride of Frankenstein film in 1935, which I think that makes sense. Though, of course, that is also an influence on later things like Susie and the Banshees and goth culture, so there's a bit of conversion evolution going on there. But Pratchett also claims that the common naming with Doctor Who's granddaughter, I know he's called the Doctor, but Doctor Who's granddaughter is a coincidence, and that Susan isn't really based on anyone, certainly not Neil Gaiman's Death from the Sandman series, which was also suggested by the annotated Pratchett commenters. And I think that one makes more sense, right? Although Susan and Gaiman's Death are both female inversions of commonly male fantasy characters and fantasy expectations, Gaiman's Death, as we've discussed, is more of a manic pixie dream girl, in contrast to the very stoic and pragmatic Susan. And as Liz pointed out to me, Pratchett has Susan deploring her name on three separate occasions in soul music. At one point, she considers that Susan is a name that made sandwiches and kept its head in difficult circumstances and could reliably look after other people's children, that it was a name used by no queens or goddesses anywhere. And here we sort of have an invocation of the Narnian Susan, although I would point out that the irony there is that Susan is or does become the Queen of Narnia. So it is the name of someone who makes sandwiches and can reliably look after other people's children and is used by queens. And when first trying out her goth attire that she wears while she's out reaping, she thinks that certainly it was a dress that no Susan would ever wear, although she suspected there was a basic Susan-ness about her which would permeate it after a while. And then we also have Death remarking that Mort and Isabel really wanted to make sure that Susan was separated from the world of the fantastic by naming her Susan there as well. So we have two reflections about Susan's name from Susan herself and one from Death. So yeah, whether it's based on any of these particular prior Susans or influences, Susan's name in soul music is meant to denote this character archetype, right? It's not a coincidence Pratchett is picking this name deliberately to represent these kinds of figures, and then, of course, inverts them by making her the hero. Although, as we saw earlier, there are some who say that he didn't really go far enough and made her more of an observer of a caretaker figure by having her sit in the sidelines of the story somewhat. But as Nuttall observes, going back to her article critical about the Sensible Susan character archetype. That's not all observed. Sometimes Sensible Susan can be the hero, as we see with Discworld's Susan Stowe-Hellett, an aristocrat, accomplished teacher, and granddaughter of Death himself. Of course, Susan Stowe-Hellett wouldn't describe herself as a hero, because heroics mean that you waste your time with sentiment instead of getting the job done and defeating the bad guy as quickly and cleanly as possible. Susan Stowe-Hellett doesn't set out to save the day. Instead, she fixes the problem. And yeah, we certainly see this in Soul Music, right? The thing that tempts Susan, that convinces her to follow the death of rats and Binky into Death's domain, is that she longs to sort out the world that holds too much fluffy thinking and put straight a world that suffers from a lack of logic. And as I said, Pratchett, by naming her Susan and characterizing like this, he is gesturing towards this archetype. It's this pragmatic part of her that seems to connect her to the Sensible Susan. But also, Pratchett's heroes are kind of just like that. Esk and Granny Weatherwax both do this, right? They are the voices of reason amid the fluffy thinking, as Susan would put it. Also, the male characters as well, right? Vimes as well. And even Rincewind are these sensible characters in a ridiculous world who are sort of put out of place and are also able to set things straight because they have a clarity about them. Like, that's kind of the point of Discworld, right? Pratchett is Susan, in that if the premise of Discworld is that to show real people responding sensibly in this magical world, Pratchett is the one who is applying this sensible logic to a place full of fluffy thinking. So while these characteristics are definitely accentuated in Susan and have drawn attention to through her naming, they're certainly not unique to her, within Discworld at least. And even beyond that, later in an article, Nuttall talks about Anne from Enid Blyton's famous five books as an example of a Susan who is not called a Susan, and who also doesn't really fit the Susan archetype, because Nuttall says that Anne is what happens when the Susan is the youngest member of the family, with no authority at all. She cooks and cleans and is cheerfully pushed around by her two older brothers and her far more interesting cousin George, and that even Hermione Granger years later takes on elements of the Susan, performing a huge amount of emotional labor for Harry and Ron, which they rarely, if ever, return, while dealing with all the logistics of the rather dismal camping section of the Deathly Hallows. And at this point, where we have all these non-Susan examples that don't fit the aging convention that Nuttall sets up as well, it has me wondering, like, is this just the female role in English children's and fantasy fiction of this era, right? It's not so much that they're Susans, is that they are the women and the girls in the story. Because yes, even in the famous five, you have George, who is the older female cousin of Anne, but her defining characteristic is that she's a tomboy. And I think we would read it these days and say that she is possibly a transgender character. Surprisingly, I haven't stumbled across a good analysis of Blyton's George from a trans queer perspective yet, and I've gone looking a couple of times, but I mean, that reading is certainly there, and I don't even think that is modern scholarship and sensibilities projecting that, right? George in the famous five is telling people to call her George because she wants to be a boy. And I kind of even feel weird referring to her as female while I've been saying this, which I'm only doing because that's how they're referred to in the books. But that is to say that George very overtly does not take on the female role in the story, which essentially leaves us with a single female character in the famous five. For people who aren't aware, the fifth one is a dog. But yes, that the one coded female presenting character in the famous five is just doing the things that women do in these stories. And the other example I would point to in refutation of these characteristics as Susan particular rather than just female fantasy characteristics is that even though you have Susan, Pevensey, and Narnia, there's also Mrs. Beaver, who also packs her family's lunches when they run off to battle, right? Where all the children go and have lunch with the Beaver family, and then when they decide to go and I can't remember what they're doing, if they're going to find Aslan or confront the White Witch or whatever they're doing. But before they go, Mrs. Beaver stops them all and tells them to get coats and that she's going to pack their lunches, and there's sort of like an eye roll. So she's not named Susan, right? This is Mrs. Beaver. She doesn't even have a first name. Which would perhaps be problematic if also Mr. Beaver didn't have a name either, right? This isn't a sexist thing, it's a speciesist thing. But yeah, we have two sort of senior female positions, right? There's Lucy, who's the younger child, and then the Honor Children, but they're playing children roles. The two female characters, besides the White Witch, who play an active role in Narnia, both do this sensible caretaker lunch packing role. So that to me says this is less a Susan thing than a female thing, right? The Susan thing is maybe just coincidental, given that Susan was just like a popular name from the late 19th through the early and mid 20th centuries. Just looking it up, like, Susan topped the list of most popular UK girls' names in 1954. That's right in the middle of when Narnia is coming out. And then still in 1964. So it makes sense that a lot of these characters in these English girl stories were called Susan, because the people that these authors and the people they knew were likely encountering in real life were named Susan. By 2020, however, Susan has apparently fallen from the top of the UK girls' names list to number 2,042, which is quite a plummet, with only 13 newborn girls recorded being given the name Susan that year. So, yes, perhaps this has just fallen out of favour, and also perhaps suggests that Susan particular characteristics that are being accentuated here, perhaps just all of Pratchett's and Lewis's characters are the same, or at least cut from the same cloth. I would also point to the Susanna-specific fantasy counterexample of Susanna Dean from Stephen King's Dark Tower series, who was introduced in 1987's The Drawing of the Three and appeared again in 1991's The Wastelands before Soul Music was published. And of course, this is Stephen King at the height of his popularity, so I'm sure Pratchett was probably aware of Susanna Dean as a character. But she is not handled very well for other reasons, but within the four protagonists of the Dark Tower series, she is the physical sort of brawn component of the four protagonists, right? She plays more of a gung-ho action role, so that might also signal, you know, sort of a difference between the American and English fantasy traditions and archetypes and things there. But it is notable that there is like another prominent Susan in fantasy literature at the time who, yeah, doesn't really fit this sensible Susan archetype. And the Dark Tower series also, by this point, I think, is referencing the idea of the turtle and the Discworld. Not Pratchett's Discworld, but it gestures towards the idea of the cosmic turtle, who also appears in It, which comes out in 1987 as well, and then becomes prominent later in the Dark Tower series. Although King never makes explicit reference to Discworld, though it always seems like he's hinting, and I don't know why, like, he doesn't. It's such an obvious point of reference that after he's already introduced this cosmic turtle and then starts getting into metafictional things and referencing other worlds, like, there are explicit references to Harry Potter and Marvel and Star Wars in the later Dark Tower books, so it's interesting that he never directly references Pratchett's Discworld when he's already sort of set it up and the connection's there. Like, Stephen King will often take that low-hanging fruit or go the obvious route. So it's interesting here that he doesn't do that with Discworld, which, again, as Pratchett was probably aware of Susanna Dean in the Dark Tower series, I think Stephen King was also definitely aware of Pratchett.
From the cradle bars comes a beckoning voice that sends spinning. You have no choice.
Moving on then, another aspect of Susan's character which relates to Victorian and early 20th century English literature is Susan's role as an orphan. And I got very excited and thought we might have been on to some more naming stuff when Les pointed out that the Wikipedia entry for orphan claims that the word shares a root with Orpheus, which seems really obvious when you hear it. But I don't think it's actually a thing. I looked into this pretty thoroughly. The citation they provide on the Wikipedia is a secondary source. So it's a citation of a citation. And the citation that source cites isn't properly cited in the book, and the text doesn't appear in the bibliography either. This is Gregory Nagy's The Best of the Archaeans, which I think was originally published in 1979 and then revised in 1998. But yeah, he doesn't provide proper citations for any connection between Orpheus and orphans. And then he also goes on to make a lot of exciting and provocative claims about Orpheus being the singer of grief, which, you know, I really wanted to latch onto for Soul Music. But again, these references don't actually appear. But again, the reference he provides for this claim does not actually appear in the bibliography, nor is Orpheus even mentioned in the book he's citing, which is, and Fryett's scholarship then quickly devolves into speculations about psychological castration and things, which suggest to me that he's not particularly credible. Apparently, Orpheus comes from the Greek orphanos, which means dark or night. I don't really know what the significance of that is, but that seems to be the Greek meaning there. So yeah, well, they might share a similar root in terms of the way they sound. There doesn't seem to be any etymological connection between the meanings of orphan and Orpheus. There's also a note on the L-Space wiki about the minstrel character in The Last Hero, claiming that there is some kind of joke about the minstrel being a bard, and therefore a reference to Orpheus, which they claim means famous or famous of name, yet nobody remembers what Orpheus was before he got his title, and no one remembers what the bard name. There's no citation or evidence for that, and I haven't seen that claim about Orpheus meaning famous anywhere else either. So again, that would have been an exciting sort of link between Imp being the Orpheus character and it being about fame and things like that. But again, there's no citation or any evidence for that, and I haven't come across anything anywhere else. Yeah, so a couple of non-starters there that I just wanted to bring up in case, you know, someone else stumbled across those references, which are on, you know, Wikipedia and the L-Space wiki, so people looking up stuff about Orpheus and Pratchett stuff might come across them, that I did investigate these, and they both led me to a dead end, unfortunately. But in keeping with the idea of Susan as a response to this Victorian and early 20th century English fiction archetypes, right? The idea that she's an orphan is very significant, especially considering the ongoing Dickensian thread that seems to run throughout the death sequence. Dickens really popularizes this idea of the Victorian orphan. I think like most of the characters in his books or the ones that are still widely read today are orphans. This includes Pip from Great Expectations, David Copperfield, Oliver Twist, Sidney in A Tale of Two Cities. There's Martin Chuzzlewit and Nell Trent in The Old Curiosity Shop, and Esther Summerson in Bleak House as well. So orphans everywhere in Dickens, right? That's a cliche of his writing. Another important contemporary orphan is, of course, Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre from 1847, who there's probably a reading of Susan as a response to Jane Eyre that I don't really want to do since I loathe Jane Eyre and don't want to think about it, but I'm sure that's there and that's another way you could look at it. And of course, there's also Dorothy in The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, which I bring up since we spent so much time of it in regards to Witches Abroad. She lives with her aunt and uncle rather than her mother and father. And while again, this adds to the idea of Susan as some kind of response to Dickensian and English literature of this period, again, it's perhaps speaking to just a broader rather than more specific phenomenon, perhaps. Like, this is a fairy tale thing. It's a device in stories starring children to get the parents out of the way, right? Like, you think in all of the Disney stories that we did talk about in relation to Witches Abroad, that, like, you know, it's a cliche of Disney movies that the parents die at the start, that the characters are orphans. And that's because these come from fairy tales where characters are often orphans or trying to escape, to run away from evil stepmothers and things. And I think this is just a common device in children's literature to sort of get the parents out of the way. Right, so the solution to all the children's problems in the stories isn't just, well, go and tell the parents about it, ask them to deal with it, and then the story becomes about the parents. Like, to keep it focused on the kids, you need to take those figures of overbearing responsibility out of the story, so you're not left wondering, well, why aren't they just getting the parents to deal with it? This is also a common trope of Bill Dongsroman stories for similar reasons, right? If you want the child to develop and mature and become independent, right, they sort of need to do that away from parental influence and authority. And in her chapter on the orphan in the Victorian novel from the 2018 collection, The Orphan in Fiction and Comics Since the 19th Century, Marion Guimnick notes that Victorian writers frequently contrast several orphans in one and the same text, which renders the motif even more visible and invites comparison, pointing out that Dickens' David Copperfield from 1849 to 1850 contains no less than seven orphans, including the eponymous protagonist and his mother. His mother is an orphan and then she dies, I think, probably. I haven't read David Copperfield. I tried. It was boring. But I bring this up because this is sort of what Pratchett's doing in soul music as well. We have multiple orphans, right? We have Susan, whose parents are dead, but we also have Imp, whose parents are alive, but who he has disowned, right? He's essentially emancipated himself and run off to the big city. So he is a parentless figure who is striking it out on his own. And the stories of Imp and Susan do parallel each other, like, quite closely. They're constantly being faced with the same sort of decisions. Susan chooses to follow Binky, and Imp chooses to go to Ankh-Morpork. They both choose to take a risk to go into these sort of unknown worlds. Their lives are both sort of overtaken by these outside forces, right? Imps is obviously taken over by the soul music, but Susan's is taken over by death and her inheritance there. This is sort of obvious, like, plot, hero's journey, sort of parallel things, but some of the comparisons get pretty granular. I mean, as Liz pointed out to me, both Susan and Imp have one troll and one dwarf friend, which seems really obvious now that's pointed out to me, but of course I'm not even thinking about it because trolls and dwarves are just the characters, the people who are in Discworld. But yeah, even there we see them as foils, as mirrors of each other. And Garmick describes three separate images of the orphan that have been shaped by Victorian writers. She calls the pathetic orphan the orphan as a figure of hope and the orphan as adventurer, which she says appear to be firmly embedded in the cultural memory to the present day, having served as a blueprint for many later orphan narratives for children, including J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter novels, Sophie and Roald Dahl's The BFG, Bod in Neil Gaiman's Graveyard Book, and also the Baudelaire siblings in Lemony Snicket's A Series of Unfortunate Events. I mean, Harry Potter's the obvious example, but again, we have Gaiman and the Graveyard Book being acknowledged, and even A Series of Unfortunate Events, which I'm pretty sure has been all but forgotten to the annals of time at this point. But these are sort of considered prominent, obvious examples, whereas Pratchett's engagement with orphans in Discworld, which again was extremely popular, doesn't get a mention, which kind of makes sense because, like, this isn't the orphan book, it's the music book, it's called Soul Music. But what the story is really about, right, what Susan's story is about is grief and death and loss. Like, we have three major plot threads in Soul Music. There's Imp story, and then the Band with Roxanne story, there's Death story, and there's Susan story. And two out of three of those stories are about grief and loss and orphanage, essentially. So yes, as Meatloaf would say, two out of three ain't bad. So yes, I think worth mentioning alongside Gaiman's Graveyard Book, at least, which is also certainly about grief and loss and being an orphan and things, but also isn't really about that much else. But just because it's not specific doesn't mean it's not significant for Susan, which, as Melanie Kimball points out in her 1999 article on orphan characters in children's literature, is that orphans are clearly marked as being different from the rest of society. She says they are the eternal other and are therefore often forced to become independent at an earlier age than other children who grow up with their parents. So yeah, we clearly see Susan playing into these tropes in Soul Music, even if she's perhaps not responding to any specific orphan character. Right, this is sort of the postmodern move. She's not really a parody of any particular orphan character. Right, there's no analogy for her in Dickens, that she is more this pastiche. She is a combination of all the things orphans do in these types of literature. She has to be like this. She has to be the cold, rational outcast among the other children because that's how orphans are. So there's no inherent parody there. It's just a presentation of the expected thing itself, but then Pratchett subverts it in other ways through Susan's role in the story, and by also, I think, suggesting that Susan's fooling herself a little bit, right? As much as she says she doesn't want to live in the world of fluffy thinking, she does run off into the fantasy world and deal with everything. So I think that might be what's going on there with Pratchett and the orphan side of things. But as Samuel Smiles notes in his 2002 book, Self-Help, many Bill Dunsmore protagonists essentially embody the Victorian ideal of self-help. He says the maxim that help from without is often enfeebling in its effects, but help from within invariably invigorates. And I think we can pretty easily apply this to Susan, or at least to Susan's personal self-image or philosophy. But as Garnick points out, Victorian orphans, including Jane Eyre and Oliver Twist, are often not entirely self-made characters, since they are ultimately saved by family members. Rachie points out that Oliver is reunited with parts of his family, and that Jane Eyre is first saved from destitution by her cousin, and then inherits money from an uncle. And Garnick says this positive impact of family members on the individual's fate also supports the Victorian idealization of the family that's going on at the same time, often through Dickens. And she even likens these kinds of characters, particularly in regards to Dickens, as fairy godmothers, which again brings up the parallels to fairy tale construction with the orphan and things, right? And if we follow that thread, go back to fairy godmothers and witches abroad, Umbrella is an orphan in that story. The whole events of that book are premised on that her parents are supposedly dead or undead or however that works. And then she has the responsibility of the Kingdom of Genua thrust upon her, which brings us into another one of Soul Music's themes that I want to touch upon quickly, which is the idea of inheritance. Except rather than the riches and social status inherited by Dickens' lower-class orphans, right? Susan inherits a job, inherits a position, which also parallels Umbrella in Witches Abroad. Yeah, the fact that Susan sort of inherits a job, a responsibility, then also taps into this ongoing theme in the Death series about labor and things like that, which is also caught up in Dickensian stuff. Right, as Garnick points out, as much as Victorian novels tended to idealize the institution of the family, they do so while simultaneously tolerating child labor. Again, the inheritance stuff is a whole aspect of soul music that I just don't have time, energy, or interest really to go into, but that's there. That's another layer of this book, as is the idea of memory, which is tied up in the other themes of grief and trauma that I'm giving short shrift. There's things there with Susan literally reliving traumatic experiences, going back and seeing death strike Mort and witnessing her parents' death and things. Like, there is a very silly and often surface level layer of all these obvious and insubstantial music puns and things that we've discussed on the other episodes that's like sitting on the top layer of this book. But at the same time, it is shouting and waving its arms about all these deeper themes. Like, you know, it opens with saying this is a book about memory and death's crisis of faith and things. I mean, this is why I think soul music is perhaps a stronger book than Reaper Man. Reaper Man has these deep metaphysical meditations going on, but that those deeper themes and meditations are here in soul music, and I think are more developed and more intertwined with the story. I mean, there is quite a disconnect between the trauma story and the inheritance and the Band with Roxanne story. Like, you could just have the story of Susan going off to find death while he's having a midlife crisis, and that would be all about the trauma and everything without really the need for the music story. Like, I guess, but I think the music plot is more substantial and more developed than, you know, the shopping trolley subplot of Reaper Man, or even the shower subplot of Hogfather that we'll get to with the wizards and thing. And of course, connects with the death side of things through the Orpheus allusions. That, like, I think there's more going on here. And while a lot of it is inference and assumption, I think Pratchett was maybe more deliberate and more in control of it than he's often been given credit for with this book.
All my life I wanted to be somebody, and here I am!
Okay, finally, I want to look at yet another of the themes that Susan and soul music engage with, which is an ongoing one for Pratchett, or just a general hostility towards formal education, which, yes, we see most prominently satirized through the wizards. But that's sort of looking at higher education and academics and things. Here, where we're looking at younger education. Because, of course, Susan is first introduced during a confrontation with her headmistress, Miss Butts, which I thought was just a funny name. This is Headmistress Seymour Butts or whatever. But apparently this is actually a reference to Frances Mary Buss, who, as a principal of the North London Collegiate School, was one of the earliest pioneers of women's education in the UK, whose name is immortalized alongside Dorothea Beale, who was the head of the upper-class Cheltenham Ladies' College, through music, in a satirical nursery rhyme that the annotated Pratchett file tells me goes, "Miss Buss and Miss Beale, Cupid's darts do not feel. How different from us, Beale and Miss Buss." Which seems like a throwaway reference, but I think it has at least a number of incidental implications. I mean, even the connection between Miss Buss and Miss Butts is a bit of a stretch, but assuming the implication is intentional, we've got this idea of Cupid's darts, which I guess alludes to Susan's budding, genuinely pun not intended, infatuation with Imp, and as well as Susan's feelings of isolation. How different from us, Miss Beale and Miss Buss, especially knowing that Susan goes on to become a teacher in the later books. But also, this is generally an indictment of the educational system as a whole. This idea of rational education as unfeeling and insubstantial, right? This is rationality versus passion, that, for lack of a better word, formal education is very academic but lacks any real-world connections and things, any real-world grounding or experience. Also in soul music, we get the first appearance of Hex, the wizard computer, who isn't named, but we have the references to the tubes are full of ants and things in the high-energy magic building. So I think that sort of disproves Eden's conception of soul music as not not really contributing to the overall cosmology of Discworld. I think their addition of Hex is a pretty significant addition, especially in addition to Susan. Like, even if she's undeveloped, I think that that's a huge addition to the Discworld canon. I think the addition of Susan and Hex alone make Soul Music a fairly significant entry in the canon as well. But yeah, this is the first appearance of Hex, who represents like the ultimate rationality, as we'll see and have subverted in Hogfather. But yeah, again, we're having the idea of academia and institutionalized education associated with unwavering rationality. Sort of like the auditors who curiously don't appear in this book. Like, it would sort of make more sense and tie in maybe a bit more with the rest of the series if the auditors were somehow behind the Soul Music, or even if there was some kind of inversion where the auditors went looking for Death to get him to stop the Soul Music and they had to team up or something. I don't know. I'm backseat writing a Terry Pratchett book years after his death, and as I'm doing a podcast about how brilliant I think it is. So let's not take that too seriously or anything. But yes, going back to Soul Music itself, there is, of course, Susan's line about how she hated literature and would much prefer to read a good book, which I think is some pretty relatable content, even as a doctor of literature. But she's shown, while she's still at school, studying a poem about daffodils. And in the only published academic monograph about Pratchett's work, which is The Intertextuality of Terry Pratchett's Discworld as a Major Challenge for the Translator from 2017, author Alexander Reisman speculates about whether the reference is to a number of daffodil poems by authors such as Teresa Hooley, Clinton Scollard, Robert Herrick, and Edward Eastland Cummings, claiming it is difficult to figure out whether Pratchett refers to any of these poems or whether he refers to any specific poem about daffodils in the first place. So this book is all about translation, and there's a lot of work about translation and Pratchett, which I don't really go in for because I'm not interested in that. It's sort of beside the point what I'm doing. But the reason why there's so much translation scholarship around Pratchett is because it is a big series that has been translated into multiple other languages that is full of pop cultural references, right? That even as I'm discovering as an English speaker from an Anglo-cultural background, you know, a lot of these jokes and ideas and inferences are very English-centric and pass me by a lot of the time, as we'll see, especially in Hogfather when we get to that. So yeah, translating not only these niche references and localizing them, or do you localize them, but also the inferences that go along with them, is far more significant and prevalent in Pratchett's work than most other authors. But I think this one is pretty obvious. I think this is pretty clearly a reference to William Wordsworth's 1807 poem, I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud, which is also known as Daffodils, and which Reisman acknowledges as unquestionably the most famous poem about daffodils. So, you know, why make it hard for yourself? I don't think this is a good example to say it could be all these other things. I think this is one is very clearly about the Wordsworth poem. But Reisman rejects this identification, since Susan complains about the poem going on for more than a page, and he says, I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud, at 4-6 line stanzas, easily fits onto one page. This is a poor rationale for that, for a couple of reasons. We could get pedantic and say, well, a lot of poetry collections are published in smaller sizes with larger formatting that spreads them out over different pages and things, but I just think it's simpler, right? So keep it simple, Susan. Just to say that this is Pratchett and Susan being flippant, and Reisman does point out that in this passage, Pratchett may simply be characterizing Susan as a girl uninterested in literary descriptions of nature, with daffodils being just a synecdoche. They're generalizing, and also that this is not the actual poem. There is no Wordsworth, there is no I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud poem in Discworld. There is some kind of equivalent. Like, this is almost a platonic sort of forms thing, where this poem is some version that is standing in for just general waffling on about daffodils, right? Like, if Alice was here, they could probably glean a bit more meaning about the poem itself, since they know a lot more about Wordsworth than me. But it's like, I think here it is a generalization. And also, the passage doesn't name the poem, right? It doesn't make any direct reference to Wordsworth or anything. It's literally just Susan talking about a poem about daffodils. So you could just translate daffodils and have the meaning and the inference maintained. Having said all that, I do wonder if the allusion to daffodils is as incidental as all that, or else I think there's just some interesting coincidences to be gleaned from it. So, against Susan's better judgment, I am now going to subject you to William Wordsworth's entire poem, I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud. I wandered lonely as a cloud that floats on high over vales and hills, when all at once I saw a crowd, a host of golden daffodils, beside the lake beneath the trees, fluttering and dancing in the breeze. Continuous as the stars that shine and twinkle on the Milky Way, they stretched in never-ending line along the margin of a bay. 10,000 saw I at a glance, tossing their heads in sprightly dance. The waves beside them danced, but they outdid the sparkling waves in glee. A poet could not but be gay in such a jocund company, which does not rhyme. I gazed and gazed, but little thought what wealth the show to me had brought. For oft when on my couch I lie, in vacant or in pensive mood, they flash upon that inward eye which is the bliss of solitude, and then my heart with pleasure fills and dances with the daffodils. And to me, that pretty clearly captures the evolution of Death's character in Reaper Man, right? Up to and including him dancing at the end with Miss Flitworth. We have him wandering, feeling alone in the cloud, and then being drawn in into nature. We have the talking about all the daffodils, you know, perhaps like the straw. Right, in Reaper Man, we have the connection between the people as the blades of grass. So carrying that metaphor over here, we sort of have the daffodils as people, and if Death is equated with the poet, right, he goes, he feels at home, he learns to love and appreciate nature by being among the daffodils, among the people, and then dances with one of them. Perhaps this is all overreading bullshit and is more likely to be coincidental and just a result of Pratchett's general romantic treatment of Death in Reaper Man. But either way, I think that adds some kind of layer to me as a reader, and also points out that as much as Susan is belittling this idea of literature and formal education and why are you reading these bland poems, that and Pratchett is often lampooning institutional education, you know, he is doing the things Wordsworth is doing. He is dipping into these sorts of things. So, you know, as much as we're meant to sympathize with Susan's dismissal of so-called literature in favor of a good book, perhaps Pratchett is also subtly or incidentally suggesting that Susan is wrong, that there is some worth to learning these things and thinking about them. This poem itself talks about experience in nature versus unfeeling education, right? This sort of foreshadows Susan taking her students and transporting them to different eras on field trips in Thief of Time and things, right? This is an indictment of abstract education narrowing a person's outlook rather than broadening. Essentially, Wordsworth is saying, live in the now, man! Maybe Susan's wrong, or at least not entirely right. Yes, while the poem suggests there is some kind of distance between academic book learning and real-life experience, there are a few passages in Soul Music that specifically invoke literature's ability to influence the real world, particularly there's a passage later that says that in addition to like the possessed, chained up magic books contained in the Unseen University Library, that it also contained perfectly ordinary books printed on commonplace paper in mundane ink, and that it would be a mistake to think that they weren't also dangerous just because reading them didn't make fireworks go off in the sky, because reading them sometimes did the more dangerous trick of making fireworks go off in the privacy of the reader's brain. So this is the idea that reading has a physical impact on the reader. Reading changes the reader. And as we've seen with like my probably completely off-base interpretation and overreading of the reference to Wordsworth poem, the way books function is also changed by the reader, right? This is the observer and the observed influencing each other and their potential meeting. This is the, sort of the idea presented here of quantum literature, which is a very Pratchett idea that is given base earlier at the start of Soul Music when talking about Mort and Isabel's romance. And I think it's like page 7 or 8 or something. So introducing, framing the entire story. Yeah, it talks about the way they respond to each other in quantum terms, saying that if it is true that the act of observing changes the thing which is observed, that it's even more true that it changes the observer. And then there is a footnote that says, because of quantum. So, right, this is a common trope that Pratchett comes back to, but this is Pratchett telling us that you will be changed by reading this book. Or if he's not directly telling us that in response to literature, he is certainly suggesting it fits into his worldview. And then we have the later passage about the Unseen University Library. Yes, yeah, specifically invoking literature's effect on the observer. So as much as Susan might look down her nose at book learning, Pratchett, who of course writes books, right? That's the thing he does, writes and reads books, is saying that for all this stuff about word experience, that literary experiences are also valuable and can have profound effects on people's worldviews, which is a very romantic and self-serving thing for an author to say, but I like it when Pratchett says it, and I like it when Pratchett says it's here. Oh, and this also brings me to something that I almost left out of the podcast, but of course I want to talk about when Susan tries on her dresses in Death's Domain, because this gives us another connection to the romantics, because yeah, when Susan's trying on her different outfits before she goes out of reaping, that's what I'm calling it, she's looking for something to wear that isn't soppy and posy, no silly black lace or anything worn by idiots who write poetry in their rooms and dress like vampires and are vegetarians, really. So yes, that's a nice little reference there. I mean, this is Pratchett sort of setting up goths in general, but this is goths, and the vampire reference makes this clear. This is goths as modeled after the Anne Rice Vampire Chronicles Interview with a Vampire style goth, which my whole reading of that, and I think it's pretty spot on, is that, and we go into this in the Vegetarian Vampire episodes, but the characters in that book, Lestat and Louis, are versions of Byron and Shelley, right? They're romantic poets, and Percy Shelley was a huge influence on the modern vegetarian and animal rights movements, like arguably the biggest influence. And while Byron was not, he would sort of fluctuate in and out of vegetarianism, mostly depending on whether he was hanging out with Shelley or not. But I do have proof from journals and things that Byron was practicing vegetarianism when he wrote the vampire fragment that kickstarted the entire modern vampire movement, as discussed in the episodes on Carpe Jugulum. So as much as this vampire stuff seems completely irrelevant, here we have a direct connection and invocation of it in soul music. So yeah, thanks for bearing with me on this one, and I'll be back with the Hogfather episodes as soon as I can. Actually, no, in fact, I have actually recorded the long-threatened bonus episode all about vegetarian vampires, or should I say bonus episodes, because that one is a three-parter, and I've got 12 hours of audio to edit down into three different episodes, one of which is entirely focusing on Discworld, right? This is something I've done with my friend Sophie Dungan, who has a book out all about vegetarian vampires and things, which is the cultural trope of vampires who abstain from drinking human blood, which is of course a big thing throughout Discworld, especially in the later books. So we spend an entire episode going through and dissecting all of that, in addition to an episode talking about the origins of the trope in vampire literature from the early 19th century and until the 1980s and 90s, and then the turn of the millennium as Pratchett's writing these Discworld novels, and then also an episode looking at everything after that, when the trope really takes off with the phenomenon of the Twilight series. So, you know, while I don't expect everyone who listens to this to be interested in that, you know, there is an entire one of those episodes that is as long as the other two, that is just going through and dissecting everything in Discworld. But in order to buy myself a bit of time, I may end up putting that out first. That is just going to be on the public feed. That won't be on the Patreon stuff, because the idea is Sophie and I want to get this stuff out there. But yes, perhaps that will come out and be the late October, early November release instead of, rather than in addition to the Hogfather episodes, and they will drop all at once so that they function as a whole. So yes, if you just want your Discworld fix, you can just listen to the Discworld episode, but the other episodes will be there to give it context as well. But yes, that will also have the added incidental advantage of pushing the Hogfather episodes to late November, early December, lining them up with Christmas and things. So I think that's what I'm going to do. I think I've talked myself into doing it while I'm talking here, and that will take a little bit of the pressure off me and my time as I'm working and also trying to edit my book, which is due at the end of the year. So that's what's going to happen. And yeah, I guess I'll see you then. Bye. And we're clear. Or rather, I won't, because I am an unseen academical, you see, although you don't.